go and see Grimaldi. Alas, replied the patient, that is of no avail to me. I am Grimaldi.
Kenneth Cranham was reading part three of The Pantomime Life of Joseph Grimaldi by Andrew McConnell Stott. It was abridged by Viv Beebe and the producer was Justine Willett. Tomorrow, the clown's lampoonery and satire take panto into new areas, but physical comedy takes its toll.
Question one. Where can you hear the original pilot edition of the News Quiz? Question 2. When can you encounter the classic long-running quiz show Have a Go? And for your final bonus point, where can you check out such quizzical gems as Many a Slip and 20 Questions? Well, the answer to all these questions, in fact, is to join me, Russell Davis, and I'll be hosting 3 hours of foraging through the BBC Radio archives to bring you the best quizzes and panel games.
Let's get quizzical. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Neil Sleat with drama and an insight into the life of Dr. Johnson. At 4, Mel Gedrowich will be here with some Boxing Day treats, including Sir David Jason, who continues his wonderfully colourful and atmospheric reading of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, and with all the ingredients for a prodigious pork pie in the 4 o'clock show. And there's comedy at 5 from a sleepy Irish town in the 1950s, Ballylennon. Now on 4 Extra, the A to Z of Dr. Johnson, the poet, wit, creator of one of the first English dictionaries and the most quoted English writer after Shakespeare. Kenneth Cranham stars as Samuel Johnson and Paul Higgins is James Boswell in Boswell's Life of Johnson, dramatised by Robin Brooks.
This must be ever remembered as a melancholy day, for it brought me the dismal news of my great and good friend, Dr. Samuel Johnson. His physician, Dr. Broxby, favoured me with a very full letter dated on Monday the 13th, the day of his death. I was stunned and in a kind of maze. I had company engaged to sup with us, and as it might have appeared a vain affectation to forbid their coming, I received them and behaved with much ease and said nothing of the dismal news. I did not shed tears. I was not tenderly affected. My feeling was just one large expanse of stupor. In the evening, I read 2 accounts of Dr. Johnson's death in the Public Advertiser and the London Chronicle. And I had a letter from my bookseller, Mr. Dilly, in the true spirit of the trade.
Could you, dear sir, have an octavo volume of 400 pages of Dr. Johnson's conversations ready by February? You might be the editor of all Dr. Johnson's works and write his life.
I am now uneasy to think that there will be considerable expectations from me of memoirs of my illustrious friend, but that habits of indolence and dejection of spirit would probably hinder me. Last night I dreamt that I was with my much respected friend, Dr. Johnson. I saw him distinctly, sitting in a chair opposite to me in his usual dress. He talked something which I do not perfectly recollect.
My library is not in such order as I could have wished.
Why not?
I'm worried because death approaches.
Oh.
It is an awful thing to die.
I was fully sensible that he had died some time before, yet had not the sensation of horror as if in the presence of a ghost.
There, sir, is the difference between us. You have got happily over.
Do not weep.
My dear sir, pray for me.
If I am to write it, I must go over my logbook. My journal kept de die in diem to when we first met 20 years ago, and I no more than 20 years old.
Tuesday, December the 14th, 1762. I have been walking about with a healthful, stout body and a cheerful mind in search of a woman worthy of my love and who thinks me worthy of hers. I had forgot this. In this view, I have now called several times for a handsome actress of Covent Garden, Louisa. Louisa. I had quite forgot. This not to the purpose. She was in a pleasing undress and looked very pretty. Where is Johnson? Thursday the 16th of December, in the afternoon, I went to Louisa's. We talked of love. I was a little bashful. I hope, madam, you are at present a single woman.
Yes, sir.
And your affections are not engaged?
They are not, sir.
But this is leading me into a strange confession. I assure you, madam, my affections are engaged.
Are they, sir?
Yes, madam, they are engaged to you.
Oh, sir.
Madam, from the first time I saw you, I admired you. I was quite happy to be here.
Oh, well, sir, you are welcome here as often as you please.
But what of Johnson? I met him in this month, surely this month. Or the next. 18th December. I then went to Louisa's. I was really in love. I felt a warmth in my heart which glowed in my face. Ah, here we are. At night, I went to Mr. Thomas Davies' shop and sat a while. I told him that I wanted much to see Johnson.
I very much wish to see Dr. Johnson. Huh? I have read his poem, London, and his dictionary, and his novel, Rasselas. But it is his essays in The Rambler.
Oh, The Rambler.
I read them aloud every night. I read them with delight and instruction, and I have the highest reverence for their author. It has grown up in my fancy into a kind of mysterious veneration by figuring to myself a state of solemn, elevated abstraction in which I suppose him to live in this immense metropolis. He teaches me how to live.
Elevated and somewhat testy, owing perhaps to the fact that the world does not treat him with your reverence.
But he is the king of letters.
He is the king of Grub Street.
How does he live?
He has narrow lodgings on Temple Lane. His wife is dead. She was much older and they did not suit, but when she died, he grieved for her. He has companions, an odd menagerie of broken-winged creatures, a doctor friend who drinks, his wife's old companion, Mrs. Desmoulins, a blind lady, Mrs. Williams, a black manservant, Frank Barber. What little money he gets from his labour, he lays out on these, and it is little, despite his fame.
Is it true he is working on an edition of a Shakespeare?
Sir, if you'll dine with me, you may ask him yourself. If you dare... Tomorrow, if you please.
So, tomorrow. How's this? 19th of December, I dined at Louisa's.
I'm in a bad humour this evening.
Oh, alas, my dear Louisa, why so?
There was a person who professed the greatest friendship for me. I applied for their assistance, but was shifted. Oh, it was such a trifle.
But pray, what was this favour? Might I know?
Well, sir, there is a person sent to me for a trifling debt.
I was a little confounded here. I did not know what she might call a trifling sum. I half resolved to say no more. Pray, madam, what was the sum?
Only 2 guineas, sir.
Madam, there they are for you.
Oh, sir...
I kissed her with great warmth. I did not meet him on the 19th then. When did I? Oh, I cannot trust myself. My memory will not serve. I have lost all heart for the project.
How do you go with your book, Mr. Boswell? Your account of your great friend?
Whenever it is finished, I shall take the liberty to present it to Your Majesty.
But when are we to have it?
Sir, Your Majesty, a little ago, remarked that people were sometimes in too great a hurry before they had collected facts. I mean to avoid that fault and shall take time, as I mean to give a very full account of Dr. Johnson.
There will be many before you.
I wish first to see them all, sir.
There will be many foolish lives first. Do you make the best?
I shall do as well as I can, sir.
I believe you knew him more intimately than any man.
He was very good to me, sir, and I was very forward with him. I shall be in no hurry. Monday, the 16th of May, 1763. Mr. Thomas Davies increased my impatience more and more to see the extraordinary man whose works I highly valued. At last,
look, my lord,
when I was sitting in Mr. Davies' back parlour, after having drunk some tea with him,
Dr. Johnson.
Johnson unexpectedly came into the shop.
Oh, you know he is much prejudiced against the Scotch. Mr. Davies, don't tell where
Mr.
I...
Mr. Johnson, may I present Mr. James Boswell?
I...
From Scotland.
Mr. Johnson, I do indeed come from Scotland, but I cannot help it.
This speech was somewhat unlucky, for with that quickness of wit for which he was so remarkable, he seized the expression "come from Scotland," which I had used in the sense of being of that country, rather as if I had said that I had come away from it or left it.
To come from Scotland, sir, is what a great many of your countrymen cannot help.
This stroke stunned me a good deal.
Tommy,
won't you sit down, sir?
Thank you. What do you think of Garrick? He's refused me an order for the play for Miss Williams because he knows the house will be full and that an order will be worth 3 shillings.
Of course,
oh,
he's...
Oh, sir, I cannot think Mr. Garrick would grudge such a trifle to you.
Mr.
Boswell.
Mr. Boswell, I have known David Garrick longer than you have done, and I know no right you have to talk to me on the subject.
Perhaps I deserved this check, but I now felt myself much mortified and began to think that the hope I had long indulged of obtaining his acquaintance was blasted.
Tom, I must go. Forgive me, sir.
His dogmatical roughness of manner is disagreeable.
There is a roughness in his manner, but there is no ill nature in his disposition.
He gave me 2 hard blows.
Don't be uneasy.
He's very slovenly in his dress.
I can see he likes you very well.
He's old.
He's 54 or 55.
He is strange. I'm sorry to leave. I have another engagement.
I will ask him if you might take the liberty of waiting on him at his chambers. Would you like that?
Yes, of all things. A week later, I went and waited upon Mr. Samuel Johnson at his chambers in the Temple. He received me very courteously, but it must be confessed that his apartment and furniture and morning dress were sufficiently uncouth. His brown suit of clothes looked very rusty. He had on a little old shrivelled, unpowdered wig, which was too small for his head. His shirt neck and knees of his breeches were loose, his black worsted stockings ill drawn up, and he had a pair of unbuckled shoes by way of slippers. As he sat in his chair, he commonly held his head to one side towards his right shoulder and shook it in a tremulous manner, moving his body backwards and forwards and rubbing his left knee in the same direction with the palm of his hand. In the intervals of articulating, he made various sounds with his mouth, sometimes as if ruminating, sometimes giving a half whistle, sometimes as if clucking like a hen, sometimes protruding it against his upper gums in front, as if pronouncing quickly under his breath. Generally, when he had concluded a dispute, by which time he was a good deal exhausted by violence and vociferation, he used to blow out his breath like a whale. But all these slovenly particularities were forgotten the moment that he began to talk.
Mankind have a great aversion to intellectual labour. Eh, Bozzy? But even supposing knowledge to be easily attainable, most people would be content to be ignorant than would take even a little trouble to acquire it.
Some gentlemen, whom I do not recollect, were sitting with him, and when they went away, I also rose.
Nay, Mr. Boswell, don't go.
Sir, I am afraid that I intrude upon you. It is benevolent to allow me to sit and hear you.
Sir, I'm obliged to any man who visits me. I love company. I generally go abroad at 4 in the afternoon and seldom come home till 2 in the morning.
But do you not think it wrong to live thus and not make more use of your great talents?
It is a bad habit, I freely own.
On reviewing, at the distance of years, my journal of this period, I wonder how, at my first visit, I ventured to talk to him so freely and that he bore it with so much indulgence. He shook me by the hand at parting.
Come again. You will come again. Come often.
I would not have dared to presume on you, sir.
Why not?
You gave me a hard set down at our first interview.
Oh, Popo, never mind these things. Come to me as often as you can. I shall be glad to see you.
I sallied forth to the piazzas in a fine flow of animal spirits and burning with fierce desire. I am an acquaintance of Dr. Johnson. Saturday, January the 1st. I conducted my charming companion Louisa to a hackney coach and away we drove to the destined scene of delight. We contrived to seem as if we had come off a journey. We were shown to our room. Sweet delirium.
Oh, sir.
The friendly curtain of darkness concealed our blushes. We awaked from sweet repose after the luscious fatigues of the night. I got up between 9 and 10 and walked out till Louisa should rise. I patrolled up and down Fleet Street, thinking on London, the seat of Parliament and the seat of pleasure, and seeming to myself as one of the wits in King Charles II's time. Thus was this conquest completed to my highest satisfaction. I was at this time so occupied, shall I call it, or so dissipated by the amusements of London that my next meeting with Johnson was not till Saturday, June the 25th.
Sir, I look upon every day to be lost in which I do not make a new acquaintance.
I had learnt that his place of frequent resort was the Mitre Tavern in Fleet Street, where he loved to sit up late, and I begged I might be allowed to pass an evening with him there soon, which he promised I should. I called on him, and we went thither at 9. We had a good supper and port wine, of which he then sometimes drank a bottle, and wishing to avail myself of the opportunity which I fortunately had of consulting a sage, I opened my mind to him ingenuously and gave him a little sketch of my life, to which he was pleased to listen with great attention.
A revolution of some importance in my existence has just taken place. My growing inclination was to take a commission in the Foot Guards. My father's wishes are that I study the law. My father is a judge. Mm. A judge. And in compliance with his wishes, I have agreed to study law. I am set out for Utrecht to hear the lectures in that university and then proceed on my travels. I am heir to my father's estate, Auchinleck. He is the laird and so shall I be. My father is somewhat narrow in his notions, but he is one of the best men in the world.
Your going abroad and breaking off idle habits may be of great importance to you. A man with talents such as yours may furnish us with useful observations upon any foreign country.
Do you really think, sir, that I would be capable of writing an account that would deserve to be read?
Yes.
I find I am at ease with you, sir. I wish I was so easy with my father. He's not much older than you, and however respectable, has not more learning or greater abilities to depress me. But what is the reason for...
Why, sir, I am a man of the world. I live in the world. I take in some degree the colour of the world as it moves along. Besides, sir, There must always be a struggle between a father and a son while one aims at power and the other at independence.
I have not yet acquired much knowledge. May I ask your advice as to my studies?
Don't talk of study now. I will give you a plan, but it will require some time to consider of it.
Will you really take charge of me? Had it been foretold to me some years ago that I should pass an evening with the author of the Ramble, how I should have exulted.
Sir, I'm glad we have met. I hope we shall pass many evenings and mornings too together. Give me a hand. I've taken a liking to you.
We finished a couple of bottles of port and sat till between 1 and 2 in the morning. Since my being honoured with the friendship of Mr. Johnson, I have more seriously considered the duties of morality and religion and the dignity of human nature. I have considered that promiscuous concubinage is certainly wrong. It is contributing one share towards bringing confusion and misery into society, and it is a transgression of the laws of the Almighty Creator. I then went to Louisa and was permitted the rites of love with great complacency, yet I felt my passion for Louisa much gone. I felt a degree of coldness for her. A licentious love is merely the child of passion. Tuesday the 18th of January. I this day began to feel an unaccountable heat in the members of my body sacred to Cupid, very like a symptom of that distemper with which Venus, when cross, takes it into her head to plague her votaries. Signor Gonorrhea. Do you know I have been very unhappy since I saw you?
How so, sir?
Why, I am afraid that you don't love me so well, nor have not such a regard for me as I thought you had.
Nay, dear sir.
Pray, madam, have I no reason?
No, indeed, sir, you have not.
Have I no reason, madam? Pray, think.
Sir,
pray, madam, in what state of health have you been in for some time?
Sir, you amaze me.
I have but too strong, too plain reason to doubt of your regard. I have for some days observed the symptoms of disease, but was unwilling to believe you so very ungenerous. What? But now, madam, I am thoroughly convinced.
Sir, I protest I know nothing of the matter.
Madam, I have had no connection with any woman but you these 2 months. I was with my surgeon this morning, who declared I had got a strong infection and that she from whom I had it could not be ignorant of it. What? Madam, you have used me very ill. Surely I place some confidence in you. I'm sorry that I was mistaken.
Sir, I will confess to you that about 3 years ago I was very bad. But for these 15 months I've been quite well. And for these 6 months I've had to do with no man but yourself.
But by God, madam, I have been with none but you. And here I am, very bad.
Well, sir, by the same solemn oath, I protest that I was
ignorant of it.
Madam,
I wish much to believe you. But I own I cannot upon this occasion believe a miracle.
Sir, I cannot say more to you. I shall lose your esteem. I shall be hurt in the opinion of everybody and in my circumstances.
What the devil does the confounded jilt mean by being hurt in her circumstances? This is the grossest cunning, but I won't take any notice of that at all. Madam, you need not be afraid. I give you my word of honour that you shall not be discovered.
Sir, is it being more generous than I could expect?
Madam, your most obedient servant. She is in all probability a most consummate dissembling whore. Let me here apologise for the imperfect manner in which I am obliged to exhibit Johnson's conversation at this period. In progress of time, when my mind was, as it were, strongly impregnated with the Johnsonian ether, I could, with much more facility and exactness, carry in my memory and commit to paper the exuberant variety of his wisdom and wit. He recommended to me to keep a journal of my life.
Full and unreserved. It is a very good exercise and will yield you great satisfaction when the particulars have faded from your memory.
I am fortunate enough to have a coincidence of opinion with you upon this subject, sir. I have kept such a journal for some time. I am very glad to have your approbation.
Keep it private, though. Private.
I like to record everything. I'm afraid I've put in too many little incidents.
Oh, there is nothing, sir, too little for so little a creature as man. It is by studying little things that we attain the great art of having as little misery and as much happiness as possible.
At night, Mr. Johnson and I supped in a private room at the Turk's Head Coffee House in the Strand. Mr. Johnson said he loved the acquaintance of young people.
In the first place, I don't like to think myself growing old. In the next place, young acquaintances must last longest if they do last. And then, sir, young men have more virtue than old men. They have more generous sentiments in every respect. I love the young dogs of this age. They have more wit and humour and knowledge of life than we have.
Oh, sir.
But then the dogs are not so good scholars. Sir, in my early years, I read very hard. It is a sad reflection, but a true one, that I knew almost as much at 18 as I do now. My judgment, to be sure, was not so good, but I had all the facts.
Am I a young dog, sir?
Are you?
I confess, sir, I am much afflicted with melancholy. Oh. It is hereditary in our family. At times, I grow indolent and careless and cannot fix to anything.
I myself have been greatly distressed with melancholy. Sometimes I've been obliged to fly from study and meditation to the dissipating variety of life.
May I now beg you again for advice as to my method of study at Utrecht?
Come, let us make a day of it. Let us go down to Greenwich and dine and make a day of it there.
By all means.
Sirs. You're a big man, sir.
No, no, my girl, it won't do.
Oh, and how you, little'un?
Me, madam? No, madam.
If you say so.
Poor woman. They lead a wretched life.
Yes.
Much more misery than happiness, upon the whole, is produced by illicit commerce between the sexes. Do you not agree, sir?
Yes. Oh, yes, sir.
Thursday, the 3rd of February. I was not so well as yesterday. I was somewhat morose. I therefore wrote Louisa the following letter. Madam, my surgeon will soon have a demand upon me of 5 guineas for curing the disease which you have given me. I must therefore remind you of the little sum which you had of me. I have been very bad, but I scorn to upbraid you. I think it below me. If you are not rendered callous by a long course of disguised wickedness, I should think the consideration of your deceit and baseness, your corruption both of body and mind, would be a very severe punishment. I desire no mean evasions. I want no letters. Send the money sealed up. I have nothing more to say to you, James Boswell. The following Saturday was fixed for my excursion with Dr. Johnson to Greenwich. We took a sculler from the temple stairs.
Tide's on the turn, sir. We'll be having good time for your worship's dinner.
Do you really think, sir, that a knowledge of Greek and Latin languages is an essential requisite to a good education?
Most certainly.
Now please just sit still, sir. You're a rock in the bar.
I beg pardon?
Most certainly, sir. For those who know them have a very great advantage over those who do not. Nay, sir, it is wonderful what a difference learning makes upon people, even in the common intercourse of life, which does not appear to be much connected with it.
And yet people go through the world very well and carry on the business of life to good advantage without learning.
Why, that may be true in cases where learning cannot possibly be of any use. But for instance, this boy rose us as well without learning as if he could sing the song of Orpheus to the Argonauts.
Thank you, sir. Remember the scholar, sir?
What would you give me, my lad, to know about the Argonauts?
The Argonauts? Sir, I would give what I had.
Good answer. This is for you.
Oh, thank you, sir.
A desire of knowledge is the natural feeling of mankind, and every human being whose mind is not debauched will be willing to give all that he has to get knowledge.
Mary Jane, Lowestoft.
It was a very fine day.
Lively lass, South.
We were entertained with the immense number and variety of ships that were lying at anchor, and with the beautiful country on each side of the river. I was much pleased to find myself with Johnson at Greenwich, which he celebrates in his poem London as a favourite scene. I had the poem in my pocket and read the lines aloud with enthusiasm.
On Thames's banks, in silent thought we stood, where Greenwich smiles upon the silver flood. Pleased with the seat which gave Eliza birth, we kneel and kiss the consecrated earth.
Silent thought, Mr. Boswell.
Here we are, gents.
Afterwards, he entered upon the business of the day, which was to give me his advice as to a course of study. We walked in the evening in Greenwich Park.
Is not this very fine?
Yes, sir. But not equal to Fleet Street. I have no exquisite relish of the beauties of nature. I am more delighted with the busy hum of men.
You are right, sir.
We concluded the day at the Turk's Head Coffee House very socially.
When do you set out for Holland?
On Friday, sir.
I must see thee out of England. I will accompany you to Harwich.
I could not find words to express what I felt upon this unexpected and very great mark of his affectionate regard. This forenoon, a maid from Louisa left a packet for me. It was most carefully sealed up, but was not addressed. I opened it up and found my 2 guineas returned without a single word written. I felt a strange kind of mixed confusion. I resolved to think no more on the matter. On Friday, August the 5th, I set out with Dr. Johnson early in the morning in the Harwich stagecoach. A fat, elderly gentlewoman seemed the most inclined among us to conversation.
Well, I've done my best to educate my children.
Indeed, madam.
I've never suffered them for a moment to be idle.
I wish, madam, you would educate me too, for I've been an idle fellow all my life.
I'm sure, sir, you have not been idle.
No, madam, it is very true. And this young gentleman with me has been idle,
sir.
He was idle at Edinburgh. His father sent him to Glasgow, where he continued to be idle. He then came to London, where he has been very idle. And now he's going to Utrecht, where he will be as idle as ever.
How could you expose me so?
Oh, but they know nothing about you. They will think of it no more.
Next day we got to Harwich to dinner. We went and looked at the church. After we came out, we stood talking of Bishop Berkeley's ingenious sophistry to prove the non-existence of matter, and that everything in the universe is merely ideal.
We are all satisfied his doctrine is not true, but it is impossible to refute it.
Oh, say you so.
I shall never forget the alacrity with which he answered, striking his foot with mighty force against a large stone till he rebounded from it.
I refute it thus.
Oh! My revered friend walked down with me to the beach, where we embraced and parted with tenderness.
I hope, sir, you will not forget me in my absence.
Nay, sir, it is more likely you should forget me than that I should forget you.
As the vessel put out to sea, I kept my eyes upon him for a considerable time, while he remained rolling his majestic frame in his usual manner. And at last I perceived him walk back into the town, and he disappeared. 22nd of October, Utrecht. Inviolable plan to be read over frequently. You have got an excellent heart and bright parts. You are born to a respectable station in life. You are bound to do the duties of a laird of Auchinleck. For some years past you have been idle, dissipated, absurd and unhappy. Johnson has furnished you with principles of philosophy and piety to support the soul. You are now resolved to make reparation by rational and prudent conduct. Sunday, the 23rd of October. Too jocular, and talked of self, particularly of whoring. In 1764 and 65, it should seem that Dr. Johnson was so busily employed with his edition of Shakespeare as to have had little leisure for any other literary exertion, or indeed even for private correspondence. He did not favour me with a single letter for more than 2 years. But on Thursday, 13th of February, 1766, I made my return to London and went immediately to Johnson.
Bossy!
Come to my arms.
I ask your blessing.
Dear Bossy, you have 25 years, and you have employed them well.
Oh, no, I have not. History, mathematics, law.
Why, sir, though you may know no science so well as to be able to teach it, and no profession so well as to be able to follow it, your general mass of knowledge renders you capable.
This was enough for me. That night, I supped with him at the Mitre, that we might renew our social intimacy at the original place of meeting. But there was now a considerable difference in his way of living. Having an illness in which he was advised to leave off wine, he had, from that period, continued to abstain from it and drank only water or lemonade.
Oh, you've kept very good company abroad. Wilkes and Rousseau.
My dear sir, you don't call Rousseau bad company. Do you really think him a bad man?
Sir, if you are to talk jestingly of this, I don't talk with you. If you meant to be serious, I think him one of the worst of men, a rascal, who ought to be hunted out of society for his immorality.
I don't deny, sir, but that his novel may perhaps do harm, but I cannot think his intention was bad.
Sir, that will not do. We cannot prove any man's intention to be bad. You may shoot a man through the head and say you intended to miss him, but the judge will order you to be hanged. Rousseau, sir, is a very bad man. I would sooner sign a sentence for his transportation than that of any felon who has gone from the Old Bailey these many years. Yes, I should like to have him work in the plantations.
Sir, do you think him as bad a man as Voltaire?
Well, it's difficult to settle the proportion of iniquity between them. Oh, my dear Bossy, let us have no more of this. It's extremely disagreeable to me. You will make nothing of this argument. I had rather you'd whistle me a Scotch tune.
Dr. Goldsmith was one of the brightest ornaments of the Johnsonian school. Goldsmith's respectful attachment to Johnson was then at its height, for his own literary reputation had not yet distinguished him so much as to excite a vain desire of competition with his great master. He was a native of Ireland. His mind resembled a fertile but thin soil. He had no settled system of any sort, so that his conduct must not be strictly scrutinised, but his affections were social and generous. He boasted to me at this time of the power of his pen in commanding money. He told me that he had sold a novel, his Vicar of Wakefield, for £400. But Johnson told me the truth of it. I shall give it authentically from his own exact narration.
I received one morning a message from poor Goldsmith that he was in great distress.
As it is not in my power to come to you, I beg you, my dear friend, to come to me as quickly as possible.
I sent him a guinea and promised to come to him directly. I accordingly went as soon as I was dressed and found that his landlady had arrested him for his rent, at which he was in a violent passion. I perceived that he had already changed my guinea and had got a bottle of Madeira and a glass before him.
That hag! That Sycorax! That withered, wrinkled-dogged, flinty-hearted daughter of the Gorgon! That desiccated old...
I put the cork into the bottle, desired he would be calm, and began to talk to him of the means by which he might be extricated.
I have a novel. Ready for the press... somewhere. I could hardly get the damn thing done for distraction. Bailiffs without and that harpy within! Here. No, that's the damnation. No. Here it is. Here.
I looked into it and saw its merit. Told the landlady I should soon return. And having gone to a bookseller, sold it for £60. I brought Goldsmith the money, and he discharged his rent, not without rating his landlady in a high tone for having used him so ill.
£60?
Stuff it up your arse, woman.
My next meeting with Johnson was when Dr. Goldsmith and I called on him with the hope of prevailing on him to sup with us at the Mitre. We found him indisposed.
Come then, we will not go to the Mitre tonight, since we cannot have the big man with us.
Johnson then called for a bottle of port, of which Goldsmith and I partook while our friend, now a water drinker, sat by us.
I think, Mr. Johnson, you don't go near the theatres now. You give yourself no more concern about a new play than if you had never had anything to do with the stage.
Why, sir, our tastes greatly alter. The lad does not care for the child's rattle, and the old man does not care for the young man's whore.
Nay, sir, but your muse was not a whore.
Sir, I do not think she was, but as we advance in the journey of life, we drop some of the things which have pleased us, whether it be that we are fatigued and don't choose to carry so many things any farther, or that we find other things which we like better.
But, sir, why don't you give us something in some other way?
Aye, sir. We have a claim upon you.
Oh, no, sir. I'm not obliged to do any more. A man is to have part of his life to himself. A physician who has practised long in a great city may be excused if he retires to a small town and takes less practice. Now, sir, the good I can do by my conversation bears the same proportion to the good I can do by my writings that the practice of a physician retired to a small town does to his practice in a great city.
But I wonder, sir, you have not more pleasure in writing than in not writing.
Sir, you may wonder.
In February 1767, there happened one of the most remarkable incidents of Johnson's life, which gratified his monarchical enthusiasm and which he loved to relate with all its circumstances when requested by his friends. This was his being honoured by a private conversation with His Majesty in the library at the Queen's House. He had frequently visited those splendid rooms and noble collection of books, and Mr. Barnard, the librarian, took care that he should have every accommodation that could contribute to his ease and convenience. His Majesty, having been informed of his occasional visits, was pleased to signify a desire that he should be told when Dr. Johnson came next to the library. Accordingly, the next time that Johnson did come, His Majesty said he was at leisure and would go to him.
Dr. Johnson!
Your Majesty?
I understood you come sometimes to the library.
Sir.
Are there better libraries at Oxford or at Cambridge, do you think?
I believe the Bodleian is larger than any they have at Cambridge, sir.
Ah, the public library. Are you now writing anything?
I am not, sir. Pretty well told the world what I know. And now I must read to acquire more knowledge.
I suppose you must have read a great deal.
I think more than I read, sir. I read a great deal in the early part of my life, but I fell into ill health and then was not able to read much.
I do not think you borrow much from anybody.
I think I've already done my part as a writer, sir.
I should have thought so, too. If you had not written so well.
When he paid you such a high compliment, did you make any reply?
No, sir. When the king had said it, it was to be so. It was not for me to bandy civilities with my sovereign.
At Sir Joshua Reynolds, a circle of his friends collected round him to hear his account of this memorable conversation.
Well, they may talk of the king as they will, but he is the finest gentleman I've ever seen. I found His Majesty wished I should talk, and I made it my business to talk. I find it does a man good to be talked to by his sovereign. In the first place, a man cannot be in a passion.
But Johnson, was you not conscious of...
Here some question interrupted him, which is to be regretted. But during all this time in which Dr. Johnson was employed in relating the particulars of what passed between the king and him,
Dr. Goldsmith remained unmoved upon a sofa at some distance, affecting not to join in the least in the eager curiosity of the company.
Goldsmith, you're not envious at the singular honour enjoyed by our friend? You're not fretting with chagrin?
Not at all. I apprehend that in all this he has relinquished his purpose of furnishing me with a prologue to my play. That is all.
But at length the frankness and simplicity of his natural character prevailed. He sprung from the sofa and advanced to Johnson in a kind of flutter.
Well, sir, you acquitted yourself in this conversation better than I should have done, for I should have bowed and stammered through the whole of it.
Perhaps he will come to see your new play, and then you may.
I wish he would. Not that it would do me the least good.
No, sir, I cannot allow this affectation to pass. It is mighty idle. In such a state as ours, who would not wish to please the chief magistrate?
No, I do wish to please him. I remember a line in Dryden, and every poet is the monarch's friend. It ought to be reversed.
Goldie, what will you write now?
I could write a good fable.
You have the simplicity which that kind of composition requires.
And, you know, in most fables, the animals introduced do not talk in character. For instance, the fable of the little fishes who envied birds flying over their heads and petitioned Jupiter to be turned into birds themselves.
Yes.
The skill consists in making them talk like little fishes. But, Dr. Johnson, this... it's not so easy as you seem to think, for if you were to make little fishes talk, they would talk like whales.
Goldsmith's incessant desire of being conspicuous in company was the occasion of his sometimes appearing to disadvantage. When his literary reputation had risen deservedly high and his society was much courted, he became very jealous of the extraordinary attention which was everywhere paid to Dr. Johnson. One evening he found fault with me for talking of Johnson as entitled to the honour of unquestionable superiority.
Sir, you are for making a monarchy of what should be a republic.
He was still more mortified when talking in a company with fluent vivacity and, as he flattered himself, to the admiration of all who were present, a foreign gentleman who sat next to him and perceived Johnson rolling himself as if about to speak, suddenly stopped him, saying...
Stay! Stay! Dr. Johnson is going to say something.
Now, really,
This was, no doubt, very provoking. The ease and independence to which Dr. Johnson had at last attained by royal favour increased his natural indolence. In his meditations, he thus accuses himself.
Good Friday, I have made no reformation. I have lived totally useless, more sensual in thought, more addicted to wine and meat. My indolence has sunk into grosser sluggishness. My thoughts have been clouded with sensuality. A kind of strange oblivion has overspread me so that incidents and intelligence pass over me without leaving any impression. This is not the life to which heaven is promised.
About this time, he was afflicted with a very severe return of the hypochondriacal disorder which was ever lurking about him. Friends admitted to visit him found him in a deplorable state. Talking to himself was indeed one of his singularities ever since I knew him. He had another particularity, some superstitious habit, which he had contracted early. This was his anxious care to go out or in at a door or passage by a certain number of steps from a certain point.
One, two, three, four.
And when he had neglected or gone wrong in this sort of magical movement, I have seen him go back again to begin the ceremony and, having gone through it, break from his abstraction, walk briskly on, and join his companion. But having once recovered from his melancholy, he honoured me with his company at a dinner with Sir Joshua Reynolds, Mr. Garrick, Dr. Goldsmith, and one or two others. Garrick played round him with fond vivacity, taking hold of the breasts of his coat, and looking up into his face with lively archness, complimented him on the good health which he now seemed to enjoy. Goldsmith, to divert the tedious minutes, strutted about, bragging of his dress.
Let me tell you, when my tailor brought home my bloom-coloured coat, he said, "Sir, I have a favour to beg you. When anybody asks who made your clothes, be pleased to mention John Filby at the Harrow Water Lane."
Why, sir, that was because he knew the strange colour would attract crowds to gaze at it, unless they might hear of him and see how well he could make a coat even of so absurd a colour.
During the following conversation, Goldsmith sat in restless agitation from a wish to get in and shine. Finding himself excluded, he had taken his hat to go away, but remained for some time with it in his hand, like a gamester who at the close of a long night lingers for a little while to see if he can have a favourable opening to finish with success. Once when he was beginning to speak,
"But how is this?
In the same manner, I maintain..."
He found himself overpowered by the loud voice of Johnson, who was at the opposite end of the table and did not perceive Goldsmith's attempt. Then when Mr. Garrick was going to speak, Johnson uttered some sound, which led Goldsmith to think that he was beginning again.
"So, we have heard you patiently for an hour. Pray allow us to hear this gentleman."
"Sir, I was not interrupting the gentleman. I was only giving him a signal of my attention. Sir, you are impertinent."
After this, Goldsmith did not take his leave, but sat silently.
Goldie is quiet.
"He is brooding over your reprimand."
"Is he so?
Then I'll make him forgive me. Dr. Goldsmith."
"Sir."
"Something passed today between you and I. I ask your pardon."
"It must be much from you, sir, that I take it ill."
And so at once the difference was over, and they were on as easy terms as ever, and Goldsmith rattled away as usual. After dinner, when we were alone, I mentioned to him that I had seen the execution of several convicts at Tyburn. None of them seemed to be under any concern.
"Most of them, sir, have never thought at all."
"But is not the fear of death natural to man?"
"So much so, sir, that the whole of life is but keeping away thoughts of it. I often meditate upon the awful hour of my own dissolution, and in what manner I should conduct myself upon that occasion. I know not whether I should wish to have a friend by me, or have it all between God and myself."
David Hume said to me that he was no more uneasy to think that he should not be after this life than that he had not been before he began to exist.
"Sir, if he really thinks so, he is mad. He may tell you he holds his finger in the flame of a candle without feeling pain. Would you believe him? When he dies, he at least gives up all he has. Hold a pistol to his breast and threaten to kill him, and you'll see how he will behave."
"But may we not fortify our minds for the approach of death?" I was in the wrong to bring before his view what he ever looked on with horror. His thoughts upon that awful change were in general full of dismal apprehensions. His mind resembled a vast amphitheatre. In the centre stood his judgment, which, like a mighty gladiator, combated those apprehensions that, like the wild beasts of the arena, were all around in cells, ready to be let out upon him. After conflict, he drove them back into their dens, but not killing them. They were still assailing him.
"It matters not how a man dies, but how he lives. The act of dying is not of importance. It lasts so short a time.
But, sir,
a man knows it must be so and submits. It will do him no good to whine.
But, sir,
give us no more of this. Leave me now. Get you gone."
"Sir,
don't let us meet tomorrow."
I went home exceedingly uneasy.
All the harsh observations which I had ever heard made upon his character crowded into my mind, and I seemed to myself like the man who had put his head into the lion's mouth a great many times with perfect safety, but at last had it bit off. After my so rough dismissal by Dr. Johnson, I sent him a note stating that I might have been in the wrong, but it was not intentionally. He was, therefore, I could not help thinking, too severe upon me. That notwithstanding his forbidding me to visit him that day, I would call and stay 5 minutes by my watch. I was glad that he was not alone.
He used to write anonymous books, and then other books commending those books. In which there was something of rascality.
Take my leave of you, sir.
Well, sir, you are now in good humour.
Yes, sir.
I was going to leave him, and had got as far as the staircase. He stopped me.
Bozzy.
Sir?
Stay a little longer. You have all possible assurances of my affection and esteem, and there ought to be no need of reiterated professions. My regard for you is greater almost than I have words to express, but I do not choose to be always repeating it. Write it down in the first leaf of your pocketbook, and never doubt of it again.
Sir. Oh, sir. This little incidental quarrel and reconciliation, which perhaps I may be thought to have detailed too minutely, must be esteemed as one of the many proofs which his friends had that though he might be charged with bad humour at times, he was always a good-natured man. When Johnson visited his famous club, which he took part to found, and which included the greatest geniuses of the age, I could not follow him there, which was a source of some disappointment to me, but I dared not ask admittance.
I wish for some additional members for our literary club.
Why, sir?
To give it an agreeable variety. Sir Joshua.
You are right, Goldie. When people have lived a great deal together, they know what each of them will say on every subject. A new understanding, therefore, is desirable.
There can be nothing new among ours. We have travelled over one another's minds.
Mm. Sir, you've not travelled over my mind, I promise you. But Boswell is a very clubbable man. Bozzy, I've put you up for the club.
Oh.
You will this evening be balloted for as candidate for admission. I have proposed you and Beauclerk is very zealous for you.
Oh? The gentlemen went away to their club, and I was to wait at Beauclerk's till the fate of my election should be announced to me. I sat in a state of anxiety, which even the charming conversation of Lady Diana Beauclerk could not entirely dissipate. And I ardently wish for his acquaintance.
Mr. Edmund Burke, will he vote for you?
I don't know.
Mr. Garrick?
I don't know.
Dr. Goldsmith? Sir Joshua?
I don't... Yes?
Mr. Boswell.
Yes.
I'm sorry to say.
Yes.
You are chosen.
Oh!
In Boswell's Life of Johnson, dramatised by Robin Brooks, James Boswell was played by Paul Higgins, Samuel Johnson by Kenneth Cranham, King George by David Hargreaves, and Louisa by Lizzie Watts. Davies was played by Philip Fox, Reynolds by Matt Addis, Goldsmith by Stephen Hogan, and Lady Beauclerk by Annabel Dowler. The director was Claire Grove.
Tomorrow, Johnson meets the brewer's wife, Hester Thrale, who becomes the most important person in his life, in the second and final part of Boswell's Life of Johnson. It's 10 years since the death of Bob Monkhouse, the much-loved comedian whose comedy career began on the stage before moving on to radio and television. We're marking the occasion on New Year's Day on 4Extra. We've managed to secure a couple of vintage gems from the Monkhouse archive that haven't been aired since they first went out 50-odd years ago, including Fletcher's Fair, which begins with some letters of appreciation from the audience.
Well, this is our third programme, numerically, not intellectually, eh? And people have taken such an interest in our little show. I mean, I had one letter that said our programme was absolutely dead right from the very start. Here it is. Oh, I didn't notice that comma before. Dear sir, you're laughing before the joke, you soppy lot. Dear sir, your programme was absolutely dead right from the
Fletcher's Fair, which we can guarantee is not absolutely dead right from the start. Part of our tribute to Bob Monkhouse, New Year's Day, at 8 in the morning and again at midday and at 7 p.m. here on Radio 4 Extra.
Listen and smile. This is the bell.
Ian McMillan marks 90 years of Big Ben's chimes on BBC Radio.
Midnight, the last day of 1923.
The first year everyone can welcome a year announced with a resounding bong.
New poems mixed with BBC archives celebrate the sound of the iconic bell.
Our microphone picked up a good deal of traffic noise, but it got the midnight chime good and hearty.
This is the bell that makes you say, Big Ben's ringing, listen now. This is the bell for New Year's Day.
Big Ben's Chimes continues tomorrow morning at 8:02 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Question 1. Where can you hear the original pilot edition of the News Quiz? Question 2. When can you encounter the classic long-running quiz show Have a Go? And for your final bonus point, where can you check out such quizzical gems as Many a Slip and 20 Questions? Well, the answer to all these questions, in fact, is to join me, Russell Davis, and I'll be hosting 3 hours of foraging through the BBC Radio archives to bring you the best quizzes and panel games.
Let's get quizzical. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Time for me to hand you over to Mel now. I will be back at 5 with an hour of comedy, starting with another visit to the sleepy Irish town of Ballylennon.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, I'm Mel Gedroych and welcome to Thursday's 4 o'clock show on BBC Radio 4 Extra. On Boxing Day. Yeah, the day after the storm. Now listen, I'm not going to indulge any Boxing Day blues, okay? It's still part of the Christmas period, which for my money goes on till January the 6th. So let's all carry on the party. With a slightly rictus smile. I know this might be a bit of a strange, startling, possibly slightly sinister image, but if you could imagine me as a Christmas fairy, I'm hanging onto the Christmas tree for dear life. My wand's broken. My mascara has run. But I'm still here. Come on, fun's been had by all. I've magicked up a box full of treats for you. Coming up, the next episode of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, read by David Jason.
The ghost conducted him through several streets familiar to his feet, and as they went along, Scrooge looked here and there to find himself. But nowhere was he to be seen.
Some man, some Liverpudlian bloke, I don't know, he keeps banging on the door trying to get in. He's got sort of very, very rigid grey hair. I don't know who he is. He's called Paul Hollywood. Apparently he's going to be telling us how to rustle up some pork pies for the next family party.
The beauty of baking is the making. The eating is almost an afterthought.
And we hear how the children's classic Danger Mouse was created.
Mark said to me, you know what you've done, don't you? Should you have drawn your brother? And bless him, he was right.
All coming up on today's 4 o'clock show. First though, pop on your thinking caps. We're off on another magical mystery tour. As ever, I will give you the 3 clues throughout the show. Your job is to work out where we're going. Your first clue is this. This country invented paper. Tough one. What country invented paper? I'll be back with another clue later in the show. We've had a delectable week so far in our Christmas baking week, finding out about Christmas cake, bread and butter pudding and chocolate log. So today we thought it was time for something a little bit more savoury, pork pies. Jenny Murray invited Great British Bake Off judge and baker extraordinaire, I say that with heavy inverted commas. Paul Hollywood is coming into the studio to make the perfect pork pie.
Paul, I have to ask you, why make your own when commercially you can buy really good ones?
You could say that about most things, you know. But actually, making your own pork pie, it's fun and it's simple and the kids can get involved. So the whole idea, the beauty of baking is the making. The eating is almost an afterthought.
So how do you start?
Right. You need plain flour and strong flour. The plain flour will give you that slight crumble. You don't want the full strong flour because the full strong flour is too much gluten in it, too much protein, and therefore too much rubbery consistency. So you break that down with plain flour. I'm using salt, pinch of salt. I've got butter in the bowl as well at the moment. And all I'm going to do is just basically crumb the butter and the flour together. And I'm just getting my hands in the bowl, making it into a fine crumb. The butter's added for flavour, purely for flavour, because I'm also going to add hot water and lard. It's a hot water crust pastry.
It's hot water and lard and butter. Hang on a minute, that sounds like a one-way ticket to the coronary unit.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. I think the beauty of this is, enjoy making it. I mean, it's not difficult. Once you've got the recipe sorted and you know that it works, then you could use this to make chicken pie. You can use a vegetarian angle to it. Obviously, I'm using pork. I'm using quite a lean cut. And I'm also adding a bit of fat from bacon.
You're still rubbing in?
Yes.
Make